United States Court of Appeals for Veterans Claims is now in session. The Honorable Amanda L. Meredith presiding. All who have business before this court, draw near, and you shall be heard. God bless the United States and this honorable court. Please be seated.
Good morning. I am Judge Meredith. To my right is Judge Toth. To my left is Judge Falvey. We are here today in the matter of Martinez versus Wilkie, docket number 17-1551. Will counsel for both parties please note your appearance for the record?
Chris Addick, Law Firm of Addick Steele, Mr. Martinez.
Good morning, Your Honor. Ashley Varga on behalf of the Secretary with Deputy Chief of Counsel Edward Cassidy.
Are both parties ready to proceed? Each party will have 30 minutes to present their arguments. Counselor for the appellant, do you wish to reserve time for rebuttal? So noted. You may proceed.
May it please the court. Judge Meredith. Mr. Martinez, in his brief, raised both constitutional and statutory arguments in support of his assertions of error. Today, I'd like to focus on the statutory arguments and dive a little bit deeper into them. Mr. Martinez asked the court to interpret 5103A(a)(1) to find that the duty to assist requires the secretary to provide a copy of a CMP or medical opinion to Mr. Martinez without request. The secretary is going to make a very different request, and they're going to ask the court to read into that statute a requirement that the duty to assist is not triggered until the veteran first makes a request. And there's four reasons that Mr. Martinez believes that that's not a workable solution, and I'll list them and then explain them. First, the facts of this case show the impracticality of that process. Second, the clear and unambiguous text of the statute does not support that interpretation. Third, there's no precedential support for that interpretation. And fourth, Congress has already made a policy choice about what direction it would like the veterans' non-adversarial claims process to go. Turning to the facts of this case, the secretary will say that Mr. Martinez or his attorney could have requested a copy of the CMP opinion because they allegedly got notice of it in the May 2016 supplemental statement of the case. That notice appears at Record 235. And if you look at the addresses on both of those, for the veteran and for the attorney, they're both incorrect addresses. The address for the veteran is being sent to 13628 Vista del Lago Boulevard, when his address is actually 3337 St. Vincent. The attorney is copied on that notice, again at the bottom left of Record 235. The zip code is 72302.
But, I mean, that's not a statutory argument. That's just, I mean, maybe notice wasn't delivered correctly, but how does that affect your statutory argument?
It goes to the facts and the impracticality of the system that the secretary is asking this court to read into the statute. They're first asking for the veteran to make a request after he gets notice. And here, neither the veteran nor his attorney got notice. But even if they had gotten
notice, did the attorney not respond after receiving the SSOC?
He responded, the attorneys for Mr. Martinez did file certain things with the VA after that SSOC, but none of them mentioned the SSOC, none of them mentioned either medical opinion that the VA relied on. So it's not clear from the record that Mr. Martinez's attorney ever saw that supplemental statement of case.
Prior to today, have you ever argued that the non-receipt of the SSOC?
We have not, Your Honor. I only raise it to the court's attention in the interest of candor because I only recently discovered that myself. It's not, as Judge Toth points out, essential to our argument, only to point out that the impracticality of the system's notice, request, response procedure doesn't work. Even assuming that Mr. Martinez and his attorney had received notice of the existence of that comp and pen opinion, we can see from the record in this case that the secretary does not have a good track record of responding to requests for production of documents. Between December of 2013 and March of 2015, Mr. Martinez's attorney made five Freedom of Information Act requests to the secretary to seek a copy of the claims file. In addition, there was a document submitted to the VA 2122A, which creates an ongoing disclosure requirement on the secretary to disclose information related to the claim to Mr. Martinez and his counsel. And it took a writ, a petition for writ of mandamus being filed with this court, to trigger the secretary to send out what they say at record 883 was a 2,299-page claims file. The RBA in this case is over 7,000 pages. Setting all that aside, the impracticality of that system, where a veteran may not get noticed, his representative may not get noticed, they may not be able to be aware of the existence of opinions, and even a request may never go fulfilled, the biggest hurdle that the secretary has to overcome is the clear language of the text of the statute. And that language says that the secretary shall make reasonable efforts to assist the claimant in obtaining the evidence necessary to substantiate a claim. Congress's judgment speaks the statutory language that it passes, and that language is clear. If Congress wanted to, they could have read in or written in a portion that said, subject to the requirements of 5701, or subject to the requirements of 5702, and they chose not to do that. The secretary is going
to
ask.
Attic, how do you respond to the argument that they did do that? That that 5103A is the general duty to assist, and then other provisions provide the specifics of how to assist. In this case, I assume the secretary is going to argue that part of that how to assist is that when you want something, you request it in writing. When you want, in this case, a medical exam, you request it in writing.
The language of the statute, Judge Fowley, I think is what makes that distinction. If you look at 5103A, subs B through D, those things specifically talk about things that the secretary is supposed to go out and get, whether it's service medical records, whether it's VA treatment records, or any other such stuff from other agencies or private sources. 5103A, sub A, is different, because that talks about what the VA must give, must help the veteran to assist him in obtaining that information. And so that distinction in the language suggests that the duty to assist has a give component and a get component. And in terms of going out to get those things, I think it's fair to ask the veteran to designate what medical records he wants the VA to help him find. I think it's fair to say that the veteran has to request from the VA what federal government agency records, Social Security, JSRRC, or any other agency that they want to get records from. I think those are fair. But I think when you talk about what's already in the secretary's possession as part of the claims file that the secretary knows that is going to rely on, because the burden lays with the veteran to substantiate the claim, it should be on the veteran to decide what is relevant to produce and what to argue and how to argue that in the claim. So I think the language in the statute, to answer your question directly, in 5103AA1, says that the secretary shall assist the claimant in obtaining. And that language is phrasing in the grammar is unique among all the other sections. The rest of the sections talk about the secretary shall obtain. This is unique and different. In order to get into a comparison or a harmonization, if you will, of 5701 and the disclosure statutes with 5103A, there has to be an ambiguity in the language of 5103A sub A, because we can't get to canons of construction without an ambiguity in the language. And nowhere in his briefs does the secretary point to any language in 5103A, A sub 1, that's ambiguous. Even if we got to those canons of construction, though.
And sorry to interrupt you, but I mean, the word obtain is, as I understand 5103A, I mean, it seems to read that it's to place in front of the fact finder all of the evidence necessary to substantiate the claim. So if it's a medical examination, it's not to mail to the claimant a copy of a medical, it's to place in front of the fact finder. I mean, that's the, in a sense, physical possession, or the place of possession for you know, what would be obtained, right? I mean, what would you say to that construction?
What I would say to that, Judge Toth, is that the veteran ultimately has the burden to prove and substantiate his or her own claim. And so while the VA under 5103A sub D has to go out, when it's necessary and relevant to decide the claim, has to go out and get a medical opinion, that medical opinion then rests in the custody and control of the VA. The veteran with that burden to substantiate the claim.
I mean, in that sense, it's obtained, right, by the fact finder. It's at the place where it would be required to serve its purpose, which is to inform the adjudication of the claim.
I would argue that the purpose that it serves is it allows the veteran to decide what's necessary to substantiate the claim, because what's in those medical opinions may be a favorable finding, as there was in the nurse practitioner opinion in this case, or it may be an adverse or an incomplete finding, as it was in the later opinion. And I think it rests on the veteran to be able to decide how he wants to approach or how she wants to argue whether that information is competent, credible, reliable, present other evidence. And if it rests only in the VA's custody and control, there's no way for the veteran to know that. And that system is patently unfair, where the burden is placed on the veteran to substantiate something without ever seeing evidence that can be used to deny the claim.
Get back to the word obtaining. So in other provisions that Judge Falvey mentioned, 5702 and 5109, when Congress meant for VA to send a copy of a document to the claimant, they used the words furnish a copy. So wouldn't we expect to see those words in 5103 big AA if that's what Congress meant, was send a copy to the veteran?
I'm not sure that's necessarily true, respectfully, Your Honor. I think that Congress, as I mentioned, speaks in very clear language, and they pass what they intend. Their judgment shows through in that language. And I think that using the word obtaining, they might use furnish, they might have used other words, but they chose to assist a claimant in obtaining. They could very well have said in 5103A sub A, they could have said that the secretary shall obtain evidence necessary to substantiate the claim, and said it that broadly, but they decided not to use that language either. They decided to be very clear and say that the secretary shall assist the claimant in obtaining. Beyond the text of the statute, going back to the text, if we get into the canons of construction and we start harmonizing 5701 and 5702 with 5103 big A, there's another more powerful canon that pulls in an opposite direction, and that's the pro-veteran canon. And that canon says that statutes, if there's ambiguity, and if we're looking at canons of construction, the court would have found an ambiguity. That particular canon says that statutes are to be interpreted in the veteran's benefit. And I can think of no statute that so clearly embodies the desire for a non-adversarial claims process that Congress desired as a requirement that the secretary, who is in possession of evidence that he knows is going to be necessary to substantiate the claim, to simply give a copy to the veteran. You can think of nothing more clearly. The precedent that the secretary goes to rely on to find that there is precedential support for their interpretation, the reasoning underlying it no longer exists. And what I mean by that is this. There's three cases that are principal to the secretary's defense: Thurber, Austin, and Anderson. Each of those three cases were decided before the VCAA. Thurber in 93, Austin in 94, Anderson in 99. And each of them relied on one common theme that this Federal Circuit touches on in Sprinkle. And the Federal Circuit in that touches upon the fact that at the time, and Thurber even mentions this, that at the time there was no certainty whether there was a constitutionally protected property interest in a veteran's application for benefits. Because of the absence of that certainty of the constitutional protection, the court in Thurber looked a little bit deeper and looked at Gonzalez, which was a recent Supreme Court case that had said that when the statute is silent on the specific process, we're going to look to the adjudicatory or the statutory scheme to determine what's consistent with its underlying principles. And that's the basis of Thurber. So the basis of Thurber, the basis of Austin, the basis of Anderson, was a VA adjudicatory scheme that existed before the VCAA. Additionally, in 2009, Cushman was decided, and Cushman said that there is, in fact, a protected property interest in a veteran's application for benefits. So the statutory system is different, the constitutional construction is different, and so the need for the fair process doctrine, I don't know that it necessarily disappears, but it certainly has changed because those two laws have changed. And as a result, I think that opens the door to ask whether the duty to assist provides for a different result, because it didn't exist at the time of Thurber, Austin, and Anderson. Ultimately, what the secretary is asking the court to do is to make a policy determination and asking the court to decide, do we want a cooperative, non-adversarial system, or do we want an adversarial system where attorneys and veterans and VSO representatives litigate a case like it's a tort claim. The duty to assist in the VCAA represented a very clear paradigm shift. We went from a system prior to 2000 where the veteran had a burden to show a well-grounded claim before any assistance from the secretary was triggered. So the veteran had a duty to do some pre-substantiation, if you will, in order to trigger the duty to assist. And Congress eliminated that with the VCAA. They said no more well-grounded claim, and they required the secretary to have that duty to assist. If this court is to follow the secretary's interpretation and require that requests be submitted for compensation and pension opinions that the secretary has already developed, that's going to create essentially a discovery right in the VA appeal system. Because representatives and their attorneys and their agents and their VSO representatives are going to know that the only way to give information from the VA is to submit requests for disclosure, requests for production, and so forth. Any such request has the ability to be misconstrued. If I request something from a court, the court may read my language differently than I intended it, and that's going to create a conflict. That conflict will trickle up to the BVA. The BVA will have to decide that. That conflict will trickle up to the court, putting this court in a position of essentially being magistrate judges in a federal district court discovery dispute. Beyond that, it's just easier and more fair to just give the veteran a copy of the evidence the secretary knows they're going to use. It's cheaper for the taxpayers because we don't have to invest the money in back and forth requests and responses from VA employees. They are more able to dedicate their time to deciding and adjudicating the claim than they are to responding to administrative requests for documents that they know they're going to produce anyway. And it creates a much more efficient system. And frankly, it's just more fair. Most veterans that appear before the system pro se have difficulty understanding these regulations and these rules. A lot of veterans suffer from conditions post-traumatic stress, traumatic brain injury, memory problems, physical barriers, educational barriers, that they aren't going to be aware of a requirement that they have to fill out formal requests for discovery in order to get a copy of their CMP opinion.
Could I interrupt you? I'd like to ask you a question about prejudice before your time runs out. In your brief, you talked about what hypothetically the appellant could have done had he been aware of this examination prior to the board decision, maybe challenge the competency of the examiner, maybe challenge the reasoning, maybe submit evidence. But in your briefs to the court, you don't actually challenge the adequacy of the exam or raise any arguments as to the competency of the examiner or contend that the appellant has additional evidence that he could have submitted. So what harm have you shown if you haven't contended that the appellant has the ability to undermine that examination in some way?
Judge Meredith, the harmless error rule goes to errors that don't affect a veteran's substantial right. And the substantial right that the veteran has is a right to see the evidence and to make the arguments against it. For example, had the veteran seen the 2014 nurse practitioner exam, which we don't know that was ever produced to him because only 25% of what appears to be the claims file was sent to his attorney in March of 2015, and it's never mentioned. If he had seen that, he would have noticed in there and been able to argue to the board that there's a favorable opinion in there that says the nurse practitioner believed that the PTSD that the veteran experienced that was service-connected aggravated his sleep apnea. He would have been able to argue that, and he might have been able to supplement that with something that would have satisfied the BVA more than a nurse practitioner. So that's one area. The other substantial right is the ability to substantiate your own claim and to get into a case and to know what the VA or the secretary is going to use to argue does not support it, and to be able to consider whether you want to challenge that evidence or not. That's the ultimate two substantial rights that the veteran is deprived of, the ability to present and argue his claim and the ability to see the evidence against him. Whether or not...
You're arguing essentially that there's an inherent prejudice here, that he doesn't have to demonstrate how the outcome would have been different had he received this examination earlier.
I don't want to go so far as to say it's inherent prejudice. I don't think that that's not what we're arguing. I think that the prejudice is clear and substantial in the fact the inability to argue. I don't think that the adequacy of the January 2016 opinion affects whether or not Mr. Martinez was deprived of the right to argue his claim. And I think we can show just by looking at that nurse practitioner exam that had he seen that at the time, the outcome could have been very different. Certainly, even had he seen the January 2016 opinion, he could have argued benefit of the doubt because the evidence is in equipoise, and the outcome could very well have been different.
Counsel, under 5104, The secretary has to provide to the claimant and the representative notice and explanation of the decision, and then under section B, among the things that notification is required for is any findings, identification of any findings favorable to the claimant. I mean, is it your contention that the SOC never contained any of that, any of the indication of these favorable findings?
I don't recall any of the favorable findings appearing in the supplemental statement of the case, but then again, we're back to the situation where we don't know whether or not the veteran or the attorney received that information in the first place. We certainly know that they didn't receive the January 2016 opinions. We certainly know we have a suspicion, a strong suspicion.
But I mean, the statement of the case at least contained a general summary of, it mentioned the existence of those opinions. It mentioned a summary of the contents and then how the adjudicator relied on them.
To a degree, it indicated how the VA, if I'm recalling the supplemental statement of the case correctly, it indicated and talked about the January 2016 opinion directly. But it didn't talk about the favorable findings, as I recall, in the nurse practitioner. And so Mr. Martinez had no ability to argue those favorable findings because he would not have seen that opinion or known to argue it. Additionally, he could have gone out and gotten an exam or an opinion that could have made the same connection that the nurse practitioner made. So I'm not sure that I'm addressing your question, Judge Dothan, and maybe because I'm not understanding it, but I see that I'm almost out of time.
Don, could you please add 2 minutes?
No, I mean, I guess what I was asking is, I mean, your argument, 5104 already includes an express statutory duty to notify. It's the things you're talking about here. And I mean, your argument seems to be proceeding under a different line that sort of we're failing to interpret 5103A properly. And if we did, we would read into the right to obtain documents, you know, certain other things. And I was just trying to suss out where exactly these notification rights would come from, where in the statute, in your argument.
There are some, if I'm understanding correctly, you're asking about where the notification to the veteran comes for the various adjudicatory actions that occur throughout the case. And I think some of those come from 5103A, where there's a duty to notify, and certainly some of the more substantive requirements do appear in 5104, particularly under the new statute. And so I think that's where some of the notice elements come from, but I think there's two components of the VCAA. That's the duty to notify and the duty to assist. And while I don't want to say that they're completely separate and apart from each other, they do serve very different purposes. And the duty to notify, there's certain things that the VA has to tell a veteran. And the duty to assist, I'm not going to argue that the court has misinterpreted that duty because it's never interpreted in the first place. This is an issue of first impression that has not been before the court before, whether or not 5103A, A1 requires the VA to assist a veteran in obtaining the evidence necessary to substantiate the claim, particularly by giving him a copy of the CMP opinion. There's no further questions. I reserve the rest of my time for rebuttal.
Counsel, you have 2 additional minutes if you need them. Please proceed.
Good morning, Your Honors, and may it please the court. The questions in this case have already been answered by Prickett versus Nicholson, in which the court determined that VA is not required either by statute or constitutional considerations to provide a claimant with a copy of a VA examination report without written request. The court in that case determined that VA was not required to provide a copy of the VA examination report because the appellant had not requested it under 5701 5702. The court also expressly determined that there was no due process violation because the appellant had been provided every opportunity to review the VA examination in question, provide rebuttal evidence, and develop her claim. Identically here, the appellant did not request a copy of the January 2016 VA examination report, was provided ample opportunity to request that report, challenge it, review it, provide additional evidence and argument, but failed to do so. Accordingly, this court, in accordance with Prickett, should find that VA was not required, either by statute or the Constitution, to provide a copy of that VA examination report. The Secretary acknowledges that the court in Prickett did not expressly discuss 5103A. However, it did not need to. Put simply, 5103A was inapplicable in that case and is inapplicable here. 5103A deals with the VA's obligations to procure evidence to help support a claimant's claim for benefits. In contrast, 5701 and 5702 deal with VA's obligation to disseminate confidential records to claimants and other parties. Appellant attempts to read in an obligation into 5103 that simply does not exist in the plain language. While he focuses on the phrase "in obtaining," that phrase is used in multiple parts of the statute, and in each instance solely refers to the Secretary's obligations to lay hands on evidence to support the veteran's claim. Even when the phrase is used regarding the inability to lay hands on such evidence, that deals solely with the Secretary's inability to obtain the evidence, rather than the claimant's inability to view the evidence. As Judge Falvey noted, 5103A, subsection A, specifically deals with the VA's general duty to assist. The purpose of that statute, as Judge Toth noted, was to obtain evidence to support the claim, obtain evidence on behalf of the claimant, presumably positive evidence, to help his claim and put that evidence before the adjudicator, who is ultimately responsible for determining the weight and relevancy of evidence. Again, in contrast, 5701 and 5702 together deal with the VA's obligation to provide evidence to a claimant or another party who requested it in writing. Again, here, the appellant submitted no such request for the January 2016 VA examination report. Accordingly, VA was not obligated to sua sponte provide that report to the claimant. To the appellant.
Counsel, let me ask you this. I mean, so there's the duty to assist, and then there's duty to notify, and there's your rules governing that, and then there's sort of disclosure requirements. So 5701 and 02 seem to me to be disclosure requirements, right? And I'm wondering if under the notification, so disclosure, notification, and then duty to assist, is there any written requirement for a notification? So, right. I mean, I understand that, VA can't just submit somebody's records to whomever. Someone calls up and they just send it out. That they need something in writing and they need to verify that this is a person to whom they can actually legally, the representative or the claimant, send the documents. But I'm curious, is there any, in a sense, in the regs anywhere where just a simple notification requirement, a discovery request type thing would require some type of written notice? I mean, are they always treated like effectively like a disclosure type situation?
If I'm not sure I understand your question, Judge Toth.
Sure. I mean, okay, so let me break it down into steps. 5701 and 02 to me read as pure disclosure provisions, right? And it's basically because there's sensitive information, VA has this process governs how VA would get, and to whom they could give that out, right? That's slightly different from a notification requirement, which is notifying the claimant of the basis of the decision, the evidence needed, things like that, which is, again, slightly separate from obtaining and procuring the type of evidence that would be needed to adjudicate the claim. And so I'm wondering, just purely under the kind of notification provisions, is there anything, your opposing counsel mentioned like a discovery type request, any regs where, if you want to get evidence just purely for the purpose of your claim, that you would have to submit something in writing? Or is it purely 5701 and 02 that they refer to?
I believe, Your Honor, it's purely 5701 okay. And 5702.
That's a long question, but I think that's the answer.
I understand your question now. And again, any request for any part of a claimant's file would be made under 5701, 5702, and VA would be obligated to provide the information requested under those statutes, assuming that it meets the statutory obligations for that written request.
Does VA notify the veteran or their counsel of those provisions and the requirements. Is there anything in the statement of the case or letters that says, we relied on this exam, if you want a copy, you have to submit a request in accordance with these sections? Are they told that?
In this particular case, it does not appear that appellant was told that information. However, his counsel was very well aware that she needed to make those requests under, specifically for a VA examination report, under 5701 and 5702, not with the January 2016 VA examination report, but with the 2014 VA examination reports. She did actually submit a letter to the regional office requesting the 2014 report, and specifically cited 5701 and 5702.
Was it provided?
That examination report was eventually provided in 2015 as a result of the writ process. In the secretary's briefing, we did include an email from appellant's counsel at the time, noting that she did receive a copy of the claims file.
But it wasn't provided separately, responsive to that written request you just mentioned?
It was not provided separately. It was provided as a part of the entire claims file that was sent to appellant's counsel. Your Honors, if there are no further questions.
Could I ask you to respond to the appellant's argument about prejudice?
Absolutely, Your Honor. This court, and as well as the Federal Circuit and the Supreme Court, have all found that an appellant does have to show some form of prejudice, and this court is specifically bound by the prejudicial error rule by Congress. And in this case, he fails to demonstrate any prejudice. At this point, appellant has received a copy of the January 2016 VA examination report by virtue of receiving the RBA in this appeal, and at this point has failed to raise any errors with the examination, any contentions regarding the report. So while he argues that he could have done so below, at this point he does not do so. Therefore, he fails to demonstrate that his case would have been any different had he received the examination report prior to the board decision.
How do we, I think Mr. Adding, unless I misunderstood him, made the point that we don't know whether the SSOC was received. How do we know that that was received? Because that's where the examination was mentioned. This is adverse to you. This could prompt the written request for a copy. How do we know that that was received?
Your Honor, unfortunately, I was unable to find anything in the record while the appellant was presenting his case, specifically noting that the SSOC was received either by the appellant or his counsel. However, appellant's counsel did submit additional argument once the case went back to the board in November 2016. And regardless, the appellant was represented by counsel who received notification, was aware of the process, that the case was going back to the board, and at no point prior to the board decision, or even after, a claimant's are given an opportunity to file a motion for reconsideration, and at no point did appellant's counsel say that they had not received notice of the supplemental statement of the case.
Did the then counsel submit anything that appeared responsive to receipt of the SSOC?
Arguably, yes, Your Honor. Appellant's counsel provided medical articles that indicated a link between sleep apnea and PTSD. And the January 2016 VA examination or VA opinion was dealing with that link between sleep apnea and PTSD. And those articles and appellant's counsel's response are at page 40 and 55 through 59 of the record.
That not only seems indicative of receipt of the SSOC, but receipt of the exam.
Are you
saying that it was responsive to the findings of the exam?
Arguably, yes, Your Honor. One would assume that if you assume that the council received the SSOC, the SSOC contained a detailed summary of the January 2016 VA examiner's findings and conclusions. So presumably, yes, those articles attempting to demonstrate a link between sleep apnea and PTSD are directly responsive to the negative nexus opinion rendered in January 2016. If there are no further questions, Your Honor, for those reasons, the Secretary asked the court follow the guidance in Prickett and finds that in this case, VA had no statutory or constitutional obligations to provide the January 2016 VA examination report to appellant without a written request.
Mr. Martinez's attorney did submit an argument in November of 2016, and she did submit with that argument medical treatise, journals, articles that made a connection in her mind between sleep apnea and PTSD. That was the theory of Mr. Martinez's case since 2005. So there's no reason to believe that she wasn't submitting evidence in support of a theory of a case as opposed to evidence in support of a document she never received notifying her of things she never knew about. I don't know how Ms. Martinez or Mr. Martinez's attorney could have known to tell the VA that she did not receive the supplemental statement of case if she did not receive it or know that it existed. If you look through that November 2016 argument, there's not a single mention of that supplemental statement of the case. There's not a single mention of favorable evidence in the November, in the 2014 nurse practitioner opinion, and there's not a single mention of anything about a January 2016 opinion. We also
contending the veteran didn't know about the exam. It was an in-person exam, wasn't it?
It was an in-person exam, and by my read of the notice of the exam, it seemed focused on neuropsych. And so I don't know that there's any indication in that exam. I wasn't there. I don't know that the veteran didn't take any notes that we have. But from reading that report, it appears that it was focused mostly on the psychological. I don't know that any questions were asked of him in terms of sleep apnea. That appears to be derived completely from the record. Again, I'm kind of construing the evidence at that point, but there's nothing that suggests that he was told it was an actual sleep apnea evaluation.
Is your real argument that there was ineffective assistance of counsel? I mean, you know, they didn't even know that there was an SSOC, that there was going to be an SSOC. They made these arguments without relying on it.
No, Your Honor, not at all. We're certainly not making any ineffective assistance of counsel argument. There was no way for Ms. Clark to know what the VA had and hadn't done. She got no notice of it. And so how could she have responded to an opinion she didn't know existed? She never was told about it. The notice went to the wrong addresses. And even if she had been told about it, we know that when the VA did produce a C file, it produced a 2,900-page or 2,299-page document. When the file produced in the record before the agency at this court is 7,826 pages. So we've got 5,000 pages of record, even assuming generously that 80% of that was developed after 2015, which I think is generous, there's still 1,000 pages that we don't know what was included in them or what was not. We have no knowledge, and there's no indication anywhere in the record that Ms. Clark ever saw these documents or these opinions. And that happens quite frequently in the system. We see it evidenced very clearly in this process where time and time again, a counsel is asking for documents and not getting them and having to make the best arguments that they can based on what they know at the time. And all Ms. Clark knew at that time was that her client had a theory of service connection of sleep apnea, that it was aggravated by the PTSD, and so she submitted evidence to support that. And that's the best that she could do at that time. So we're not making any ineffective assistance. I think that was quite effective. To the best that she could do at the time. The counsel, secretary relies on Prickett. And I would like to point out that in Prickett, the issue was whether the fair process doctrine required production of the medical opinion. The fair process doctrine is not the duty to assist. The fair process doctrine was created in 1993 because there was no known constitutional property interest or protected property interest, and there was The adjudicatory scheme at the time was the well-grounded claim, which put the onus on the veteran at that time to trigger the duty to assist. So it was decided under a system that was markedly different from what we have today, where there is no trigger for the duty to assist. It exists. Now, there's certain steps that have to be followed, and those steps appear in 5103B to D. To answer your question, Judge Toth, if I understand it correctly about the regulations going to notice, 5701B is an interesting, I think it's B1, is an interesting paragraph because it provides that records shall be given in a claimant's file to three categories or classes of people: the veteran, the veteran's representative, and independent medical examiners. Now, it's talking about the ones that are outside the VA system in terms of providing them. And I'm certainly going to speak outside the record anecdotally, and I know the court can't rely on that, but I have yet to see a situation where the secretary has ever asked an independent medical examiner to submit a request for disclosure of the C file before providing the opinion. It's automatically given. The secretary is selective in who they want to make requests, and they want the secretary, the veteran, and the veteran's representative, but they don't hold independent, external to the VA examiners to that same standard. There is one regulation, I believe, that talks about requiring that when the board goes out to get a medical opinion, I think it's 20.903, that talks about when the board goes out to get its own opinion, that it has to give certain, take certain steps. It is 20.903, I'm sorry. And that is interpreting 7104 and 7109, not the duty to assist, but it provides three steps. It says that when the board makes the request for the opinion, it has to notify the veteran it's making the request. When it receives it, it must furnish it. And then 60 days from furnishing it is the time limit that the veteran has to respond and provide additional evidence.
Right, and I mean, presumably the difference between 903 and I think it's what is 3.159 is, unless 903 existed, the veteran would never, I mean, the appeal would be decided and the person would never have the opportunity to respond to it. I think implicitly is in 3.159 the idea that you can appeal, you know, the SSOC will have all this information and you can take issue with it before the board on appeal. I mean, you can challenge it, you can request it, you have certainly the opportunity to respond to it. Whereas if the board just sua sponte kind of got an opinion, used it to decide and never gave the veteran the opportunity to respond, there would really be no opportunity to respond at all.
And in that situation, if the board was to get that document, that's where the fair process doctrine comes in, is when evidence is developed after the latest SOC or SSOC. And in that situation, if the board goes out to get an opinion, 20.903 does not alleviate or take away the fair process doctrine of notice in that situation. And so 20.903, I think, is carving out a procedure that it wants the board to follow to ensure that the veteran does get the opinion, consistent with 5109, consistent with 7109. And there's no reason to believe that Congress would want different procedures simply because the exam and opinion was gathered from outside the VA rather than inside the VA. If anything, it seems more logical that the veteran would have to request, after getting notice of an outside opinion, that they would have to request a copy of that, as opposed to stuff that the VA has in their custody and control already that they know they're going to rely on. The Congress set a policy when they passed the VCAA, and they wanted a cooperative and non-adversarial claims process. That policy is embodied in 5103A, A sub 1, where they require the secretary to assist the claimant in obtaining that evidence. And this court's precedent, relying on fair process doctrine, predates all of that. This court cannot overrule Congress in terms of policy concerns. The Congress has set those, they've made that decision, and they've spoken in terms of their judgment about what they want. And what is very clear is that they do not want a discovery process where veterans have to make requests, followed by disputes over those requests. And so we ask the court to find that the secretary shall make reasonable efforts to assist a claimant in obtaining evidence by giving him, without request, a copy of any CMP opinion that it develops to substantiate a claim. There's no further questions.
Thank you, counsel. The case will be submitted for consideration. The court is now adjourned. We will come down and recounsel.
All rise.